Good afternoon, everyone. The Health and Human Services Finance Division will come to order. We have today a present. Okay, we don't have a quorum yet, so we're going to wait to approve the minutes. But I would like to get started with Commissioner Malcolm, who's going to give us a presentation on the Department of Health's base budget activities. And welcome to the committee, Commissioner Malcolm. Yesterday in the policy, HHS Policy Committee, Commissioner Malcolm gave a really good overview of the her department's activities. But, of course, we saved the budget for this committee. Unfortunately, we have only some overlap of members. So we do have members on this committee who really won't have had any real introduction to the Department of Health, but I don't want to, you know, I know that you would probably be happy to meet with anybody who has questions afterwards, but I would like to try to stick as much as we can to the budgetary activities that will be more before this committee. And members, as we've tried to do in the past, I would ask you to make note of your questions and ask them at the end of each section if there are sections that we can pause at. I don't know, Commissioner, if you have your presentation organized in that way, but I would just want members to hold their questions unless it's a question like, what is that acronym, or I can't understand what, or what page are we on, or something like that. We'll try to let you get through your presentation at least in chunks before we ask any substantive questions. So thank you for being here. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Good afternoon. I'm Jan Malcolm, Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Health, and I have also with me Margaret Kelly, who's our Chief Operating Officer at the Health Department. I'm very familiar to many of you as our state's budget officer for the last many years. Madam Chair, I was kind of anticipating doing kind of a really high-level summary of what we covered with your Chair Moran's policy committee yesterday, but I'm going to go really quickly past that and will, as you requested, focus mostly on the budget issues. But members, you have copies of the overhead, the slide presentation here, and please don't hesitate to let me know if you would like some offline conversation, because it's a really fascinating story, what public health actually does and what we know about the health of Minnesotans and about what's driving some of our trends in terms of not only the health status of our people, which is our major concern, but also what we're spending to produce that health status in terms of trends in healthcare spending and coverage and so forth. So that's part of what we talked about yesterday in the policy committee. I'm going to give you just a super brief tour of kind of the concepts, but then go right into the budget discussion. We had a great opportunity in Chair Moran's committee yesterday. I so appreciated it, to really talk at some length about what is public health and why does it matter. And the first few slides in this presentation are really about, you know, what is public health. And we referred with the policy committee to the United Health Foundation rankings that have been going on for 20 years or so. And you can see on this slide, we rate enviably high on many measures of the health of our public on average, and it's an impressively long list of areas in which we're number one or at least in the top 10. But there are some areas in the same ranking system, just an interesting data set for you to refer back to, where Minnesota does not rank very highly compared to our peers, and some of those statistics may be surprising to you, and they bear more discussion about why are we not faring as well in some of these public health indicators. So we have the good and the bad, and then the ugly I refer to as really our state's very troubling and persistent patterns of health inequities. When you look below the averages, which we have learned is so very important, we can no longer think that we're doing a good job by the health of the public in Minnesota if we're only looking at the averages, because underneath those averages we have some of the worst gaps in the nation between the majority population and populations of color and Native Americans. And that is something that continues to concern us deeply and deserves, and I'm sure we will have a chance with Chair Moran to go deeper into what we know about health disparities and what some strategies might be to reverse those trends. This next chart is really just such an important thing conceptually when we talk about Health and Human Services policy and Health and Human Services finance strategy to really be informed by what we know about what actually influences population health, what influences the health of groups of people. It's not just health insurance, as we certainly know. It's not just access to excellent clinical care, which is obviously very, very important. When people need care, it's so important that they have access to that care in a timely way, in an appropriate way. But that, in fact, is only a small percentage of what actually determines the health status of the population. And the evidence around this is just growing in leaps and bounds in recent years. The influence that factors other than access to clinical care have on the health status of populations. We've known for a long time, of course, how important health behaviors are, the choices that we make. But more and more, we understand that those choices are made in important community contexts. That either reinforce or limit access to healthier behaviors and access to opportunities. So this broader picture of what really determines health is just very, very important when we're making difficult and challenging budgetary decisions about where to invest our resources. We ought to be informed by what do we know about what actually produces results at the end of the day. And this fuller picture of what influences population health is, I think, an important guidestone for all of us. We spent a few minutes with Chair Moran's committee talking about the difference between human services and health. The Department of Human Services, of course, is where we make such important investments in the health of Minnesotans through direct investment in services, which is not to say that DHS isn't interested in prevention, but the majority of their budget is really spent on intervention, on getting people access to services, whereas the whole idea of public health and the main strategy of public health is to try to understand risk factors and patterns and trends, and, as we say, go upstream to try to mitigate risk factors and anticipate trends and build prevention strategies to prevent problems from occurring in the first place, so that we hopefully can make sure that the spending that we're doing on the intervention side is as effective and as efficient as possible. So just that contrast between intervention and prevention is a good thing for us to keep in mind. The next chart is really, I think, quite fascinating and compelling from a healthcare finance perspective and a health policy perspective. It looks at the comparisons between the major industrialized countries of the world, what we spend on healthcare services and what we spend on human services. And we spent a lot more time on this in Chair Moran's committee, but understanding that previous chart about the determinants of health and what actually produces health status for populations, this starts to help us answer the question, why do we spend so much more in the United States on healthcare, and yet our population health statistics are nowhere near the top of the pack for all that spending? And it appears to have something to do with the ratio or the relationship between healthcare spending and social services spending, given that bigger pie chart that we just looked at also briefly on the social determinants. So what you see on the next slide then is, so this is showing our international comparisons. This next slide, the top bar there is the national level, United States distribution of health spending. About 95 or 96% is spent on medical care, so care kind of after the fact, and about 4 or 5% is spent on prevention before the fact. So that's, again, sort of part of the story is we spend an awful lot intervening after things have already happened, and really, relatively speaking, surprisingly little on systematic efforts to try to prevent things from happening to begin with. At the state budget level, the bottom bar chart there, just simply for the purposes of this committee's purview, You know, the Health and Human Services spending, as you can see, is very heavily weighted to the intervention side of the equation. DHS, not only healthcare programs, but DHS programs that are related to human services as well. And the MDH portion of that budget, as you can see there, kind of mirrors that national pattern, which is not to say we shouldn't be spending money on intervention. That's not my point at all, but that it just kind of puts in context for you how relatively little we're actually investing in the prevention part of the continuum. So we also talked in Chair Moran's committee about kind of the economic imperative of getting our of really thinking about our investment strategy in health and human services. That what's really driving healthcare costs in Minnesota, this is not new news, but it's chronic disease. The burden of chronic disease in terms of the health impact on people, on families, and on budgets, whether that's governmental budgets at the state or local level or private sector budgets or family budgets, it's chronic disease that's driving our costs. And we know how many people in Minnesota are faced with chronic diseases and what that cost burden is on them. And really what's in the pipeline, if you will, in terms of people who already have chronic diseases who are going to be incurring many, many more health conditions in the future. So this slide and the one that follows it really just are kind of some pretty sobering statistics about the amount of money we're spending today on chronic disease, how many people in our population currently have chronic diseases or have risk factors that are likely to lead to chronic diseases, and what that might lead to in healthcare costs in the not too far distant future. So it's just a way of trying to say, you know, our concerns for the health of our people is obviously not just about the budget. It's one of our most fundamental jobs is to create the conditions in which people can live healthy lives and have access to all the opportunities for participation in our society. And just in pure economic terms, getting our strategies lined up to do more to prevent chronic disease to begin with is an economic imperative. And that's, I think, where public health comes in. So the next couple slides are just for those members of the committee that are not as familiar with our work. The Minnesota Department of Health has offices, as you see here, all around the state. We are sort of hubs of public health expertise spread around the state, working in close partnership with local public health agencies in all of your jurisdictions, where really a lot of the rubber meets the road, so to speak, in terms of how we execute public health strategies in your local communities. And, of course, in addition to local public health, we work very, very hard with other sectors as well. Now segueing into the budget part of the conversation, and, again, I just would welcome longer conversations with any of you about some of the substance of the work that we do and why we feel so passionately about the value that is for Minnesotans. So to the budget.
So, Commissioner, maybe this would be a good point to just pause for a moment. First of all, I want to announce that a quorum is present. So we have that out of the way. And so I don't know if members have any questions about this part of the presentation, but this would be a good opportunity before we get into the budget. Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jen, I just had a question going back to page number 4 on the public health in Minnesota specifically. Immunizations for children. Could you explain a little bit why we're so low on that?
It's a great question, and also yesterday I said that we would come back with some additional breakdown of that statistic, because that is very, very surprising. So which populations is that, which immunizations? It is important to say that when we look at the number of kids immunized by the time they reach school age, then we're back at the top of the chart. So some of the underperformance here is in early age immunizations in certain population groups. But I can get you a more precise answer to that later.
Thank you.
Good. Thank you.
All right. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And on the slides where you talk about the bad and the ugly, I wrote on both of those, why? What's the solution?
We're looking for answers.
And that's coming in the next page.
All right.
In all seriousness, Madam Chair, Representative, I think, you know, the story of where are the gaps and where I think also tie very much to that broader picture of the social determinants of health. It's not only a question of how are we investing health care dollars, but when it comes to homelessness and educational success, that this kind of goes to the intersection of these issues, that when we see inequities in health outcomes, they tend to be similar root causes to the inequities in education outcomes, in earning, and it's just there are the deeply rooted questions of how are we doing and making sure that opportunity is really equitably distributed in our state. I mean, that's a big thing to say, but I think to unpack that and some of the work that we're now doing across agencies and in partnership to try to understand the connections between housing strategies and health strategies is, I think, some of the really encouraging work that is beginning to happen.
Representative Hamilton, any more? Okay. Representative Moran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So in my committee also yesterday, we talked about the rates of infant mortality and low birth rate. And I think in that conversation you stated it was the lack of access to clinical care. Could you talk a little bit more about that?
I think yesterday's conversation, Madam Chair and Chair Moran, we were talking about infant mortality as a particularly good predictor, and it's actually not just access to clinical care, though that is important. Maternal mortality and infant mortality both highly amenable to, obviously, clinical interventions, but that's not enough. And the single biggest predictor of infant mortality, by some researchers' estimates, is maternal income security. That it isn't health care at all. It's the circumstances of the mom that are predictive of infant mortality results. Housing stability, job security, adequate resources to provide for the child. So I think it goes to that, again, that social determinants picture, which doesn't mean to de-emphasize health care, but to say that the best clinical care in the world is not sufficient to overcome all of those other influences that predispose people to higher risk or poorer outcomes, that we need to take that more holistic look and that holistic picture at what actually influences health.
Madam Chair.
Representative Moran.
So I agree with all of with that. But I was reading an article, and I think there's some new data out around African-American women who are just really struggling with infant mortality and low birth rate. And, you know, I think sometimes we'll make the assumptions that when we look at the African-American community, there will be women who are in the low-income bracket who may have who may be struggling with housing and all the indicators that we just talked about. But, in fact, they said it was no income levels.
Right.
These was professional women, and it was, like, often the stressors of being an African-American woman that was calling the infant mortality and the low birth rates. Could you talk a little bit more about that?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Chair Moran, I'm so glad you made that point, because that is absolutely true, that again, it's not just a matter of differential treatment in the healthcare sector, although that also appears to be true at all income levels by race. So that when we talk about the work that healthcare systems need to do to understand racial inequities within their sphere of influence, that's real. Quality does vary, it appears, by race and ethnicity across the income spectrum, and that's something we in healthcare delivery need to own and are taking very seriously. But it's not just treatment differentials, it's also just the greater risk that as you point out, that folks under chronic stress that shows up in a whole variety of ways in terms of a higher risk profile for health. So thank you for mentioning that racial inequity around maternal and infant mortality is one of the most shocking statistics in all of these data.
Thank you. Representative Neuer.
Madam Chair, Commissioner, looking back into 2014, the report Advancing Health Equity in Minnesota, I think it was noted it's a matter of life and death, according to that report. what have we learned from that report? What has changed?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Noor, that was, thank you for mentioning it, that was a breakthrough report, I think, nationally in public health to be as explicit as that report is about the fundamental root causes of some of the inequities that do result in differential health outcomes, a matter of life and death, as the report said, is deeply rooted in just sort of the structural inequities in our society. And that while we've been working hard in clinical care to try to do a better job collecting data by race and ethnicity so that if there are quality differentials, we know about them and we can work to improve them. Minnesota Community Measurement and others have done a great job making more refined systems to measure quality of care to make sure that we can illuminate differences where they exist by different demographic characteristics. But again, the repeated point here is that just focusing on health care alone is not enough. We have to look at those other social forces, those community forces that create differential access to opportunities for people in our society. And I think what we're learning is that when we're doing grants in the Eliminating Health Disparities Initiative, which you'll see in the budget, it's very important to get communities engaged in all of those areas, those policy areas that influence their health outcomes, and not just, again, I hope I'm clear on this point, it's not in any way to suggest that access to care and access to insurance aren't important. They're sort of the front door to the system. But only focusing on health insurance and health care is not going to be enough to close those disparity gaps that we know we need to work on, you know, improving equitable access to opportunity in all of those policy domains. And that's really where the conversation has shifted over the last decade or so, is this more inclusive and holistic look at what's causing the disparities to begin with. Are we making fast enough progress to close the resulting health inequities? I would certainly say no. But when we understand the depth of kind of the community conditions that are creating the inequities, it starts to explain a little bit why that needle is so hard to move, why it's not just a matter of making sure that the healthcare providers are looking at their data and closing the quality gaps where they can close them in treatment outcomes, but that it's these broader societal issues as well.
So, members, I apologize. I have allowed us to get pulled off our primary mission here this afternoon, and I know that members have a lot of important questions for the commissioner because this is, of course, a primary concern to the people on this committee. But unless there are burning questions, I'm going to allow her to go forward and give us the budget part of her presentation. That's our primary task here today. So go ahead, Commissioner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So this next chart is just traces over the last number of years, individual fiscal years and biennia, kind of what the pattern of spending in MDH is. And this is with all of our funds. So one of the first things you'll notice, and it might be a little easier to see on the pie chart that follows, is the significant degree of funding that we at the Minnesota Department of Health get from the federal government. And that is the bright green line there. The blue is the all other funds, and the dark the black is the general fund. So might be surprising to you how relatively small a part of the MDH budget comes from the general fund. The majority of it is from federal, and then all other includes things like the healthcare access fund, fee revenues, and so forth. But you see there that there's been ups and downs in spending, not huge rates of increase. We're actually between fiscal year 15 and 16, there was a pretty material decrease in federal funding that we're starting to move up just slightly in the last couple of fiscal years with that federal funding and other sources of funds. But you can see fairly stable levels of funding from the state's perspective. The next charts perhaps are graphically easier, again making the point that almost half of the department's budget comes from the federal government, only 18% from the general fund, 10% from licenses and fees, 6% from the healthcare access fund, and 18% from all other funds. And there's a little more data in slides to come about what comprises some of those other funds. So that's what comes in. the sources of funding, the uses of funding, important to note that over 60% of the funding that comes to MDH goes back out to the community in terms of grants and aids and subsidies to local public health, as well as to rural health care providers and community grantees. So that's quite important to note. Compensation for MDH staff is a little over a quarter of the budget, and other operating costs, 13%. So the majority of our funds we are the stewards of, and we administer and design programs, which then go out in grants to that local and community partnership that I talked about. The next picture just shows you of the staff at MDH, almost 1,500. I can't tell you what a privilege it is to be at MDH and to work with these folks. They are excellent technically and excellent in terms of their mission commitment to the health of Minnesotans. The staff that we have, and you can see some of the types of folks at MDH on the left there. Again, over half of the staff are directly funded by federal dollars, about 25% of the staff funded by licenses and fees. Only 11%, so 162 people at MDH are funded by the general fund, an additional 74 people by the Healthcare Access Fund, and then the all other sources. So that's one of our strengths as a department, is the diversified nature of our funding and the fact that we're really, really good at getting federal dollars and being very successful in competitive grant opportunities for federal funding, I think, is a real strength of ours. However, we don't get into that position without the support of the state as well, to be able to have the level of expertise that allows us to compete so successfully for those federal dollars. The next chart just tells you a little bit more in detail about those federal sources of funds. You can see the main funding agencies that we work with, certainly the Centers for Disease Control, but note the first line there. The U.S. Department of Agriculture is actually our biggest federal funder in dollar terms, that coming mostly through the Women, Infant, and Children Nutritional Supplement Program, $126 million in Minnesota, which, of course, we're concerned about in the federal shutdown. We all certainly hope that the shutdown is over before we run into a problem there, but that is looming large on our radar screen right now. Centers for Disease Control, over $75 million, and you can see the rest there. But we do work with all these different federal agencies, which kind of speaks to the breadth of our work, not only in infectious disease, but in environmental health, in nutritional supports, environmental protection, and homeland security in terms of emergency preparedness, which is another very critical public health function that we are always at the ready to respond to public health emergencies of all sorts as they arise. I did want to make a quick point about the Healthcare Access Fund, and I know that your next presentation is about the Access Fund, so I will just simply say there are a lot of activities that we administer at MDH that are funded by the Healthcare Access Fund that we think are extremely important to our health improvement strategy and to our healthcare cost containment strategy and to the whole kind of reform strategy that we have in Minnesota, that we spend $17.5 million each year through the statewide health improvement partnership, which goes out and now is in every county in Minnesota, some really robust community-based cross-sector partnerships to work on prevention, as I've been talking to you today about the importance of doing much more to get upstream and to start appreciating the cross-sector opportunities to better align strategies at the community level to work on prevention. Communities are making great use of those SHIP dollars and have built really impressive cross-sector partnerships, which not only are enabling the SHIP grantees to work on the big three risk factors that SHIP was designed to do, that being healthy eating, active living, and avoidance of commercial tobacco, and we've got some results we'll be bringing forward to you later this session to kind of show what have we done with the decade of SHIP, what do we have to show for it. Not only are we making meaningful progress on those big risk factors, but communities are also using that infrastructure very impressively for community-based priorities and concerns like the opioid crisis or like what's happening with suicide trends. The communities are using those SHIP convened collaborations to start looking at other local community public health concerns as well. So that SHIP program is very, very important, we believe. Also, you can see there the investment that we make in strategies to improve cost and quality in the healthcare delivery sector of our healthcare system, as well as direct loans and workforce development strategies for that are benefiting the entire healthcare workforce, but particularly around underserved areas and rural communities. So just a note for you there about the importance of the policy discussions you will be having about the future of the Healthcare Access Fund, that it isn't it's not only the subsidized insurance programs that are funded by the Access Fund, but these critical health system investments as well. So now, Madam Chair, transitioning into a little bit deeper dive in, so I've showed you kind of the big picture of what does the MDH budget look like, where does the money come from in broad strokes, and where does it go, now drilling down into the major budget activities of the department. This gives you a picture, and we've still tried to be quite high level here in this presentation, for the major budget activities, and that's different from our organizational chart. So if you're looking to align this with what I talked to Chair Moran's committee about yesterday about our complicated org structure, this is the way we aggregate things for budget activity purposes is its own thing. So now I'm tracking with the budget book and the budget activities.
And Commissioner, if I could just pause there. So she just mentioned the budget book members, and we will have those for you. They're being finalized, prepared to be handed out, and this is of course not just for the Department of Health, but also for all of the budgets that are within our purview and the committee are in this book, and it's pretty detailed, and you will have your own copy, and it will allow you to look in detail for each of the agencies and activities that we do in these areas. But, Commissioner, I just want to ask you sort of one foundational question, or maybe point out a difference here. Of course, our largest budget is DHS, and I don't know if members fully appreciate the vast difference in size between your agency and DHS, and I think I kind of think of it like the sun and the moon. It's so, you know, even though we have you here, we have them here, but members should really understand that, you know, in just in terms of size and dollars, that they are vastly larger. Not vastly more important, however. I just want to be careful to say that. But one of the differences when we think about our budgets is that a lot of what we do with DHS, we're always thinking about drawing down federal dollars because we have Medicaid and the match that we get from the feds, and we get matched, and we're always talking about waivers because we might want to do something. We don't want them to take away the money they give us, so we're always applying for waivers. In your area, is there some of that as well, or is it mostly that the money you get from the feds kind of stands on its own? How does that work? If you can kind of give me the compare and contrast there, just sort of in general terms, and then, well, I'm sure it's different in each budget area as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We do strongly believe that the federal investments accrue to the direct benefit of Minnesotans, but often we can leverage those federal investments to add to priorities that the state legislature has also declared to be a priority, the opioid crisis being a very good example of that. So I think in terms of grant funding that we get from the federal government, it's not quite the same share relationship that DHS has, but there is that same leverage opportunity. One area, though, in which we do have sort of a shared funding responsibility and get federal match is in our regulatory activities, regulation of health facilities, where we are working on behalf of the federal government to license and inspect healthcare facilities, hospitals, nursing homes, and the like, where there is a required state match for federal funding to do those activities, and we also have some facilities in Minnesota that are not federally certified, that are state-only certified, that are paid only by state dollars. So that gets to be a complicated story of how that federal-state match works. But similar to DHS, when we come to you with regulatory proposals, that you know the federal government will be paying the lion's share of the cost for those proposals in federally certified facilities. So that's a parallel there.
Thank you, and I'm sure that you know, as we go through, maybe not today, but as we do the real, you know, when we get the governor's budget and we start to really dig into the details, I'm sure we'll be talking more about that. But I just really wanted to flag that for members and understand it a little bit better myself, because I think that when we work in the, when we come into the Health and Human Services area in the legislature, it's one of the really confusing things about this area of our work is the federal state interaction and how it changes across different things we do. So thank you.
Please. Thank you, Madam Chair. So I know we're short on time, but the intent really of these next few slides is just to give you kind of that bigger picture grounding in the budget, so that when you look at all that detail in the budget book, you can maybe put it in a little bit higher level context. So these numbers track with what you'll see in that detailed book, but this is kind of the kind of a high level summary, if you will. So one of our major budget activities is in community and family health, and on slide 22, which you see there. So this is the community and family health budget area, which comprises the Women, Infant, and Children program, which I already mentioned to you, almost 200,000 Minnesotans, family home visiting, which has proven to be a very, very powerful upstream strategy for improving children's outcomes, not only in the health arena, but in education as well, and a very important program for children with special health needs to get them and their families connected to supports and services, 35,000 children and families served there. So you can see at the top line, this community and family health budget activity bucket, if you will, is 32% of our agency. So almost a third of the agency funding is in these kinds of programs in community and family health, dealing with women, infants, and children, parenting, supports to families, and so forth. So, and you can see in the bottom line, and the same format we use for each budget area here, so the top line, how big a part of the agency is this, and the bottom line, how else is this budget area funded? So here, too, you see the relationship. We've already talked about this, that this budget area is predominantly funded by federal funding as well. So, and again, I'm not going to go through each bullet point here, but you can see the kind of programs, and this is not a complete list, it's just illustrative of the kind of programmatic activities we do in community and family health. So the next big budget area is health promotion and chronic disease. I went on at some length about the importance of chronic disease to what's threatening the health of our people and what's driving health care costs. This is the part of the agency where we not only are working with healthcare providers on what are best practices to the management of chronic disease and screening for diseases so that we can catch things as early as we can, but also working to understand risk factors and to work at the population level to kind of bend the curve, if you will, on the trends that are producing the chronic disease to begin with. So in this program area, we have the screening programs that you see there for cancers, working on diabetes education, diabetes prevention for those at heightened risk, and this also is the area of the department where our work on opioid, not only intervention but prevention, is placed, and the priority that the legislature and governor have placed on that in recent years, we hope will continue to grow. But as I always say when we're talking about the opioid crisis, it's right that we are focusing on that, and we always like to point out that the trend lines for alcohol abuse, other drug abuse, deaths and illnesses related to alcohol, other substances, and suicide are on the exact same trend line as opioids. And so it's important for us to kind of have our heads around what are some common things that might be influencing that cluster of what public health nationally is kind of referring to as a cluster of diseases of despair and disconnection, and trying to understand the links and the relationships between those things and what we can learn that applies from prevention approaches in other arenas to this cluster. So just wanted to kind of call that out for you there. I'm just going to keep on moving unless you stop me. The next big budget area in the budget book is called Health Partnerships and Equity, and that really wraps together a number of different parts of the agency structurally. This is where we work with local public health agencies. This is where we work on the Eliminating Health Disparities Initiative and with the grantees in that program. And those are really the main activities here. And you can see kind of the data. There are 51 community health boards serving all of your districts. $81 million per year goes out in state grant funds to the community, the local community-based public health system that works on all that we've talked about. So infectious disease, environmental health, prevention, emergency preparedness. So that I just can't say enough about the importance of keeping our eye on the health of the whole system, both the state and the local public health infrastructure that we rely on to manage these risks. So I think that was sort of the main part of the budget. Actually, there are a couple more. I guess we've got just a couple of examples of the kind of work that this is funding. We've talked about the advancing health equity work. We've been working with community-based organizations on health equity strategies, again, for almost 20 years now. And I think that's an important story worth telling, is how those efforts have matured and evolved, and what we're doing a little differently today with funding than we did in the early years. So I'd love to come back and talk with you more about that. The next big budget area, statewide health improvement. And this I mentioned already. This is the not only the statewide health improvement grant program that was funded starting in 2008 as a really significant part of Minnesota's big health reform effort back then, really an understanding that we needed statewide prevention strategies to get at the long-term cost trends. So this is where the statewide health improvement funds are. And you can see there the importance of the healthcare access fund to that. In addition to the SHIP work, this is where our state-level investment in tobacco prevention activities also is found. We'll be talking as the session goes along about the implications of Clearway, Minnesota, that was funded with tobacco settlement dollars back in 1999, the implications of them reaching the end of their court-ordered limited lifespan, and what will be coming next in terms of tobacco policy and control in Minnesota. But for now, the state's direct investment is a little over $3 million in tobacco control. And one of the things we've just done recently is with the latest results of the student survey, we saw an alarming uptick in student use of e-cigarettes and vaping, and have been really putting a lot of effort into working with schools and trying to raise awareness on the part of parents and kids that this is a cool new thing, but this is a dangerous thing. This is not just harmless vapor. There are dangerous chemicals, and the nicotine in these e-cigarettes is very concerning for the developing brain. So just that's a good example, I think, of kind of what we try to do in studying the data to spot perhaps changes in behaviors and trends so that we can bring to all the relevant parties alerts the importance of it's both an old threat in a new form. We know about the importance of keeping kids from getting hooked on nicotine and other substances, but now it's taking a whole new form. So it's important to just stay current with continuing to look at the data. Next budget activity is health policy, and I mentioned this in the kind of the upfront overview of the department. It's a really important kind of analytic function that we provide to study the system itself. What's happening with changes in patterns of insurance? Who's remaining to be uninsured? How is the pattern of insurance changing in terms of people getting coverage from private sector sources versus public? How much of the total cost of care is being funded by what type of insurance? How is the burden shifting between out-of-pocket costs and sponsored costs, if you will, or insured costs? And then, again, we talked about the efforts that we make to help shore up the healthcare delivery infrastructure itself with grant funding to community centers and rural providers. This is also where the Office of Vital Records lives within the department, so that's part of this part of the budget as well. Then another separate budget activity, one of the newer activities of the department, is to run the state's medical cannabis program. You can see here it's a very, very small share of the agency budget, funded by a combination of general fund and fees. It's a program that has had rapid growth. Happy to talk about that in greater depth with anyone, either the committee as a whole or interested members kind of how this program has grown, what we've learned about, and we continue, I think, to make really kind of important contributions nationally because our program is so, I think, rigorously designed. It's a very medically focused program, different than a lot of other states that have taken, you know, kind of a bit more, and we've heard some criticism for this too, that our state's overly restrictive in terms of how we've built this program. But it's got a really kind of strong medical and pharmaceutical link to it, and we do contribute a lot of experiential information from our providers and our patients who are using the system in terms of their self-reported outcomes into the national dialogue about what we're learning about the application of medical cannabis to certain conditions.
And Commissioner Representative Hamilton has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner, first of all, I did receive a prescription from my doctor for medicinal cannabis. And it was good for 3 months in order to get this filled because I deal with some pain and muscle spasms. However, the first month went by. The second month, my driver's license didn't match where I lived because we moved to a different home. And I was supposed to get a utility bill, but my wife pays the utility bill and then throws it away. By the time I got a utility bill, my prescription elapsed. So I never did get it filled.
Uh-huh.
And I wanted to be able to come and share my experiences with this. With that said, I do have a question. Are we able to do, we, the state of Minnesota, any of our colleges, are they able to do additional research as the benefits of medical cannabis because of the issues we have with the federal government?
So, Commissioner, I will ask you to maybe just comment briefly on that because we're, you know, I do want to kind of get through this, and we have another thing scheduled.
Yes.
But, you know, Representative Hamilton, I know that you're not the only member who's really interested in this.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't be surprised if we heard some bills on this session, at which point we probably will get a lot more in-depth conversation. But please, Commissioner, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hamilton, I'll just say you put your finger on one of our biggest frustrations is that the state of the literature is just not great yet on what we know about effects, and we think that much more research needs to be done and federal policy needs to evolve so that we can do more studies of this nature. So love to talk more with you about it.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Please continue.
Okay, the next big budget area is environmental health, which is another very large part of the department in terms of not only its programmatic activities but its reach. We work with more than 7,000 public water systems all over the state, and we try to do that in a very proactive way, not by waiting for systems to fail testing, but continually working to educate local water suppliers, to be working with them on prevention strategies to keep their systems healthy to begin with. This is where our oversight of the safety of restaurants, of food distribution, the recreational industry, so that the regulatory oversight of those industries is in this part of the department as well, as well as the environmental review aspects of various kinds of development projects. So you can see there it's a relatively important part of the agency's overall public health impact. Infectious disease. The next big budget area, perhaps what we're best known for in Minnesota historically, is the excellence of our infectious disease activities. And this, again, is overwhelmingly federally funded activity, which is, I think, good and also makes us a little bit kind of vulnerable, if you will, to the restrictions and the priorities of the federal government in terms of where those resources can be deployed. As I mentioned, it's a strength of ours that we're very good at competing for federal resources, and federal resources come with federal restrictions in terms of what the grant requirements for those federal dollars are. That's an obvious point to make to you, I know. So this is where infectious disease surveillance systems. We've got great partnerships with healthcare providers and local public health all over the state to always be monitoring for infectious diseases. We've got a great kind of interconnected alert system. So when something pops up, everybody knows about it quite quickly and can work together to identify and contain outbreaks. You can see here just some of the data of conditions, and this is, again, just illustrative. This is far, far, far from a comprehensive list of all the things that happen on a daily basis in the infectious disease section of the department. So the example here is, you probably recall, we had the largest measles outbreak in the country in 2017 that was in our Somali population and was the result of a pretty low vaccination rate among the Somali population, which was a result of some understandable kind of just cultural norm differences as well as some misinformation that had been promulgated in the community. And it was not only a good example of just sort of the scientific acumen of controlling an outbreak in a very responsible way, but the ways in which, informed by some of the equity work that we've been doing over the years, we were able to work very successfully with the Somali community on strategies to educate and keep educating, and we've seen a really material difference in rates of immunization as a result of that work with the community. Next budget area, the public health laboratory. Again, a small share of the of general funds goes into here. This is a real mix of federal and fee-based and other revenue. Just an extraordinary resource for the state. We have one of the best public health labs in the country, and we're used as a lab that gets involved in piloting new things and working with CDC on emerging conditions. And we're often a reference lab for other labs around the country. So it's a real point of pride. And this capacity comes directly from the state. And when I was commissioner the first time, my last session, we worked to get funding for the new lab building and the bonding bill. And it's kind of a really, just on a personal point of pride, it's pretty cool for me to be able to work in a building that I worked on getting funding for. So thank you for that opportunity. But seriously, it's just a great example of a state investment in a capability and a capacity that's now got Minnesota in a real nation-leading position, also enables us to be the first ones to get access to some of the newest the newest science and the newest testing capability, which is largely paid for by the feds, but is used for the benefit of programs beyond just the federally funded ones as well. Down to the last two budget areas, the next one, health regulation. This is where our oversight of healthcare facilities from acute care to long-term care to individual types of health professionals resides here. Again, you can see it's quite a mix of funding sources, a significant amount of fee revenues as well as federal with that and general fund for the state federal match that I just alluded to briefly before. And this is, again, this is regulation of facilities, individual providers, and also health plans, health insurance plans, with respect to things like provider network, we certify kind of the presence and the robustness of quality assurance methods within the health plan. So health insurance regulation is something we share with Commerce, but we have some important aspects of quality regulation in MDH over the health insurance field. So that is the regulation division. I'm really giving this short shrift, but hope that you will ask questions later if you have them. Finally, the Health Operations Bureau, kind of the inner workings of the agency to keep the place running and to keep our information systems and our human resources systems up to par and supporting those wonderful employees that we have and being able to deliver and oversee competently all of that fiscal management that we have for all of this complex funding that we have and that we administer for others. So that is our budget in a nutshell. I just leave you with the slide that I left the policy committee with, which is that the funny thing about public health is the better it works, the less you see of it. You know, the better we are, the more invisible we are. The more we prevent, the less you are thinking about prevention, which is just sort of been the classic quandary for folks in public health for decades. We, appreciate Madam Chair's reminder of, you know, what a small slice we are in your entire budget purview. But we think it's a high value slice, and that we like to say, you know, prevention is it's invisible, but it's not invincible. It doesn't happen by accident. You know, we don't prevent things successfully just because we were lucky. We prevent things because we know what we're looking for and how to spot trends and how to intervene quickly. So just the fact that the better we get at it, the further below the radar screen we are, I hope that you will be as mindful as we are that takes continued vigilance to make sure that we protect our capacity to keep a lot of things off the radar screen.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Thanks, Madam Chair.
I would say small but mighty.
Small but mighty.
Yeah. So, all right. I don't see any questions, so we're going to move to our next presentation. Thank you again.
Thank you.
For your 2 days of presenting to our committees. It's been very, very good. And I'm going to take a moment to ask for a motion to approve the minutes while they're getting up there. Do I have a motion to approve the minutes? Representative Hamilton moves to approve the minutes of January 22nd. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. Minutes are approved. Thank you very much, Representative Hamilton. And so we have our fiscal analyst for this committee, Doug Berg, and we have Anna Minky from Minnesota Management and Budget, and they are going to give us an overview of the little fund that could, I guess, maybe we could call it. Quite a bit in the news right now, the Healthcare Access Fund, because of what everybody on this committee knows, because of the sunset of the provider tax that is coming upon us, and that is a big topic for this session. And so we thought it would be useful for everybody to get on the same page and just learn the facts about the fund that is not entirely from that tax, but a lot of it is. So so I don't know who's planning to start. Mr. Berg?
Madam Welcome Chair, I am. I'm Doug Berg. I'm the fiscal analyst for the committee. And I'm going to just take a few minutes to go over sort of the a little bit about the history and the context of the fund. And I'll go through that pretty quickly, but just sort of how it got to be where it's at, and then Ms. Minky will handle sort of the current financial situation. And I'll skip over.
Mr. Berg, are we starting? You have slides, I guess.
Yeah, Madam Chair, you should have these in your packet, and I'm not going to cover quite every slide. There's an outline of what I'm going to cover, but really to jump to the third page is where I'm going to really start talking. And from a historical perspective, the Healthcare Access Fund dates back to 1992. And it exists as a fund in Chapter 16A.724 of state statute, which is the Minnesota Management and Budget statute, and has sort of the state's basic financial stuff in there. The legislation in 92 did kind of three main things. It created the Minnesota Care Program. It instituted both the provider tax that members are familiar with, and which is going to expire at the end of the year, and the gross premium tax that I think people think less about. And then it also created the Healthcare Access Fund itself. And I just want members, it seems obvious, but to differentiate between the fund, which is a legal entity in the state treasury, and its revenues and uses, which come from what this committee and statute appropriates out of it, and what statute puts into it in revenues. So, and legislation, I'll cover that. And it was historically, the main purpose for it was funding the Minnesota Care Program. Other than that, in Chapter 16, there are very few requirements relative to the fund. The fund is established, like many funds, it receives the income from its, the investment income from the fund itself goes to the fund. There is a transfer in law from the fund annually to the general fund that I'll come to in a minute. And there is authority for direct appropriations for Minnesota Care to be used in either year of the biennium. And that's kind of all that's in the this enabling statute. Few facts about it, just basic finance facts. Most of the funding out of it is direct appropriated. That is, in our bill, the Human Services Finance Bill will have appropriations from this fund. That's where most of the appropriations occur. There are some statutory appropriations, but most of it is directly appropriated. The main sources of revenue, as I mentioned, are the provider tax, which is a 2% tax on medical providers, hospitals, surgical centers, and wholesale drug distributors, and the 1% gross premium tax that applies to HMOs, nonprofit health plans, and community ISPs. As I mentioned, the main expenditure historically was the Minnesota Care Program, but that is no longer the case. The main expenditure at this point is the Medical Assistance Program. And currently, the Minnesota Care Program falls a ways down the list. It's like the fifth or sixth highest appropriation right now. Like most things, the state's revenues and this fund with it, the revenues and expenditures are updated at the state's revenue projections in February and November. So the data that is available now is from the November forecast and will be updated at the end of next month. And as I mentioned, there are several statutory transfers to other funds for a couple of items that I'll come to next. I'm going to skip over these slides on revenues and expenditures because they'll get covered in Ms. Mingy's presentation. So if you skip to what is slide 7, I'm going to talk a little bit about transfers in and out of the fund just very briefly. There is a statutory annual transfer out of the fund to the Department of Human Services for IT costs, which currently is around $14 million a year. And these are IT relative to managing the Minnesota Care Program is the idea behind it. In 2007, a statutory annual transfer was set up out of the Healthcare Access Fund to the General Fund. It did say up to $46 million annually was transferred. It was transferred in order to pay for an MA rate increase that was adopted in 2003. Then in 2014, well, in 13, the legislature adopted most of the enabling legislation for the Affordable Care Act. And in 2014, we began, well, it should actually say 2011 through 17, transfers were out for to offset costs of MA expansion. That really is in two parts. There was the early expansion of mainly adults without kids up to 75% of federal poverty level who had primarily been taken care of by the Minnesota Care Program, who were by direction of the governor in 2011 brought into the MA program as part of the ACI. Transfers were made from the general from the Healthcare Access Fund to the general fund to cover the cost of that to the general fund because they had previously been paid for by the Healthcare Access Fund. And then in 2014 we started covering the 13 legislature in the ACA and enabling legislation expanded from 75% of federal poverty level to 133%, and at the same time established annual transfers in fiscal 14 through fiscal 17 to make the cost to the general fund of that expansion zero. There were also additional savings to the Healthcare Access Fund for that, but the transfers into the general fund were so that the general fund did not pay any cost for the MA expansion. Going on, you see in 2017, the annual transfer of $46 million to the general fund, the value of that, again, it was hooked to a rate increase. The value of that rate increase was updated in the governor's budget to $122 million annually. That's what the statute says now, is up to $122 million annually. And the up to will become important in a little bit. It basically means the fund pays that to the general fund if the fund has the money. In 2015, the legislature chose to appropriate $455 million from the general fund to the Healthcare Access Fund in 2015 and use that to increase the amount of medical assistance expenditures that came out of the Healthcare Access Fund in the 16-17 biennium. And I should note that, well, it'll come up that the 2014 was the first year that the fund had direct appropriations for medical assistance. Prior to that, they had come entirely out of the general fund. In the 18-19 biennium, the legislature transferred $200 million each year, or $201 million in 18 and $219 from the Healthcare Access Fund to pay for the to the Premium Security Plan account, also known to members as the reinsurance program. That was a one-time biennial transfer of $401 million out of the fund. And Ms. Mingy will cover, there's a $50 million transfer into the fund this year related to savings from chronic disease. That's all I'll say about that for now. In recent years, a number of pieces of legislation have been passed that affect the fund. The first one that members will be thinking of is in 2011. The legislature passed, and it was enacted, a sunset of the existing provider tax. That, in current law, the provider tax is a 2% tax, sunsets on December 31st of this year. The premium tax is not affected, but the provider tax goes away on the end of the year. In 2013, as I mentioned, the legislature passed legislation implementing the Affordable Care Act, which then, as you go on, in 14 had the first direct appropriation for medical assistance out of the fund. And on the 1st of January on 2015, the Minnesota Care Program officially became the state's basic health plan, which had made changes to who it served, what income levels they were served at, and importantly, our reimbursement from the federal government. And then in 2015, as I mentioned, the value of the annual transfer from the Healthcare Access Fund to the general fund was increased from $48 million a year to $122 million a year. Moving on, one of the slides that I have with numbers on, but most of the numbers will be in Ms. Mingy's presentation, but in this committee and elsewhere, it's really necessary to look at the general fund and the Healthcare Access Fund together to determine kind of the fiscal health of both. This slide looks at, from the November revenue forecast, the top line is the Healthcare Access Fund's ending balance, and you'll see that it is current at the end of the 18-19 biennium. It has $667 million balance. At the end of the upcoming 2021 biennium, it has $48 million, and by the end of the 22-23 biennium, it has a deficit of almost $1 billion. Now, I will say that the fund can't actually run a deficit. That is, the fund will be short of its of revenue at that point. And again, Ms. Mingy will cover that. If you go down to the next line, you see the same figures for the general fund. $720 million balance in the current biennium, $1.5 billion in 2021, and $1.9 billion in the tails. You combine those, you see that what you have is a declining balance because the Healthcare Access Fund does not have enough money in it. And if you add the estimated inflation numbers from the forecast in the out two biennia, if you add those together, you have, by the end of 22-23, you have a net deficit of almost $2 billion when these two funds are considered together with the inflation estimate. Now, I should mention, these are each number in this depends on the prior ones. And with everything we do, every change in legislation, every forecast, the numbers change. But this is a static view from the November forecast. Going on to the page 10, events that will affect the fund, as I mentioned, the provider tax is repealed as of December 31st, 2019. That is at 12 at midnight on the last day of the year. It will be gone. Last November, the revenue forecast came out that was the first one to include the fiscal 22-23 biennium. And it showed, as a lot of people expected, that the fund would not have enough revenue to cover its expenditures beginning in fiscal 22. And, of course, in the final event that affects it is this legislative session in the governor's budget, which will adopt a budget for fiscal years 20 and 21, but will also consider the tails for 22 and 23. Just finally, kind of the obvious thing, there are options on what to do. You can raise revenue, you can reduce expenditures, or some combination thereof. There's the possibility of eliminating transfers, although, as Ms. Mingy will cover, some of that happens automatically. Funds could be transferred in, or a funding source could be transferred in, or what the fund is liable to pay for could be transferred out. That would likely be medical assistance, which is the largest single expenditure. And finally, you could have a bigger restructuring, which could involve merging the healthcare access fund with the general fund or elimination of the fund. And so some combination of those things will be needed to happen before fiscal 22. Madam Chair, that's all I have to cover.
All right. And Mr. Berg, on the last page here, you don't have removing the sunset as a policy option.
Madam Chair, I think it's covered in the first one that is raise revenue, reduce expenditures, or both, or transfer a funding source in. That is certainly a funding source, and that is one way that you could have revenue to the fund.
Okay. I personally don't view it as any of these options, but that's a matter of opinion, I guess.
Well, Madam Chair, it was meant to cover that option and all the others.
All right. So. Thank you, Mr. Berg. I appreciate that. All right. Ms. Mingy, do we have a question? I'm sorry. So we have 15 minutes for Ms. Mingy's presentation. Representative Grunhagen has a question. Maybe if we could make that a brief one, and then we're going to, believe me, we're going to cover this in greater detail in addition. So,
then I'll pass right now.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate that. Schultz, Representative Schultz, same deal?
Mine's technical.
Please.
Okay, so on page 7 of your slide deck, the fifth bullet, in 2015, $455 million was from the general fund went into the healthcare access fund. Was that also to do the MA expansion, or was that also to cover additional MA expenditures outside the expansion?
Madam Chair, Representative Schultz, it was the latter. It was not part of the expansion. It was simply a shifting of where part of the medical assistance program's costs were paid from the general fund to the healthcare access fund.
Okay, thank you.
Good. Thank you very much. Okay, Ms. Mingy, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Anna Mingy from Minnesota Management and Budget. Can members hear me all right?
Yes.
Okay, great. So I'm happy to be here today to provide the committee with an overview of the Healthcare Access Fund. Mr. Berg provided the committee with a really great overview and history of the fund. So today I want to focus on the current balance, sources of revenue into the fund, and then how funds are used, and then sort of wrap up with looking at the ongoing structural balance of the fund. So as Mr. Berg just sort of described, the Healthcare Access Fund is forecast to have a balance of $667 million in fiscal year 2019, our current year, but that at the end of fiscal year 2021, our budget period, the estimated balance is $48 million, and at the end of fiscal year 2023, the planning years, we forecast a negative balance of $969 million. The estimated balance of $48 million in fiscal year 2021 is only slightly lower than the end of session 2018 estimates, which forecast a balance of about $61 million. And as you just heard, the November 2018 forecast is the first forecast that officially provided estimates for the 22-23 biennium, where we're really seeing the full impacts of the sunset of the provider tax. This chart shows the uses of the Health Care Access Fund in the current biennium and the next, the sources to the fund. The largest resource in the current biennium is a 2% tax on providers, hospitals, ambulatory surgical centers, and drug distributors. In the current biennium, that makes up about 80% of revenues into the Health Care Access Fund. If you look into the next biennium, the budget years, that falls because the tax sunsets halfway through fiscal year 2022. So the forecast only reflects a partial year of revenue in that year. If we were to add the planning years, 22-23, on this chart, that dark blue bar would disappear entirely. The next largest revenue source is a 1% tax on HMO premiums, and that brings in about $90 million. Or $100 million a year. The fund also receives premiums paid by MinnesotaCare enrollees, and those are spent directly on the cost of care for MinnesotaCare. We also reflect a transfer from the general fund in each biennium of different amounts. In 2018-19, we reflect a $50 million transfer into the fund, and that is the result that was triggered by a study conducted by the Department of Health, in which they estimated state spending on chronic disease and compared that to projections, and the actuals fell below projections, which triggered the statutory transfer. In the next biennium, there will be a $7 million transfer in from the general fund, and that was related to some tax changes made a couple legislative sessions ago. So other revenues in the fund include interest earned on the balance and then some federal reimbursement to the Department of Human Services for administrative activities that they conduct in the fund. I wanted to note that the provider tax in statute, at the same time the tax was repealed in the 2011 session, the legislature established a contingent rate reduction for the tax. So to the extent that the sources of revenue into the Health Care Access Fund were 25% more than the uses in the fund for a given biennium, it would trigger a reduction in the provider tax. But because of the patterns of revenue and expenditures in the fund, that rate reduction has not been triggered. This chart looks at the growth in tax revenue into the Health Care Access Fund over time. You can see that provider tax and premium tax revenues have grown steadily. Between 2008 and 2018, revenues from the provider tax have grown about 4% on average per year, which is pretty much in line with the rate of growth for healthcare spending generally. In that same 10-year time period, revenues from the HMO premium tax grew about 5% on average a year. Our forecast, or the Department of Revenue's forecast for premium taxes, they estimate they'll grow on average 4% a year for the next 5 years, and that forecast includes factors like what do we expect about the future of private health insurance spending. What is notable in this graphic is that the dark blue bar grows steadily over time and then falls from 2019 to 2020 and then disappears in the last 3 years of our forecast horizon. So moving on from revenues into the fund to how the money is spent. This chart displays the current biennium's uses of funds. MinnesotaCare was historically the largest use in the Health Care Access Fund and is the program most commonly associated with the Health Care Access Fund. But as you can see, total Minnesota Care spending, both the state appropriation and the portion coming from enrollee premiums, is just over $100 million per biennium. So those two sort of slices of the pie are about 6% of the fund's spending. The state appropriation, the portion of Minnesota Care that's funded from the, you know, the provider and premium tax, is in this biennium about $32 million. The currently, the largest expenditure in the fund is medical assistance, which is just over $800 million in the current biennium. This amount is set in law, so the original appropriation, there was some attempt to tie it to program changes and expansions, but over time, it has just fluctuated based on changes in the value of the appropriation, and it offsets the cost of the program to the general fund. There are also appropriations to state agencies. So the Department of Human Services receives about $96 million in this biennium, and that they use that for the cost of administering Minnesota Care. And as Mr. Berg mentioned, some of that is transferred out of the fund to pay for the cost of running the IT systems that operate Minnesota Care. The Department of Health, and I apologize that my slide says MDH grant program. As you just heard from Commissioner Malcolm, MDH administers many grants and programs out of the Health Care Access Fund, including the State Health Improvement Program, the Health Economics Program, Health Care Homes, a number of rural health programs, and loan forgiveness programs. We currently forecast that we'll transfer $244 million in this biennium from the Health Care Access Fund to the general fund. That transfer originated to pay for a rate increase when we expanded the provider tax and the premium tax to public program enrollees, and to so the cost of care for those people, there was simultaneously a rate increase provided to offset the cost to providers and plans. So that's sort of the origin of that transfer. It has increased over time as the value of that rate increase has grown because the underlying costs of medical assistance in Minnesota Care have grown. And then sort of a notable one-time use of the Health Care Access Fund was the Premium Security Plan, through which we transferred just over $400 million out of the fund to pay for the cost of the state-based reinsurance program. That is not reflected in the forecast for future years because it was sort of just a two-year appropriation.
Okay. One more. I have a question from Representative Loeffler. Representative Loeffler, she just has one more slide. Should we maybe let her get through that
one?
Well,
I was just going to ask about this particular chart.
Please. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm just wondering, since this was traditionally the funding source for the Minnesota Care Program, and then we converted it under the Affordable Care Act to our basic health plan so we could take advantage of really amazing federal reimbursement, why were the federal dollars connected with that not put in this fund? Just trying to understand why we put some things in the general fund and some things we put in, like, the Health Care Access Fund, because I would have thought when we made it the BHP program under the ACA and brought in all this new federal money to cover Minnesota Care, it would have gone into this fund. And maybe I just need to get a basic answer of how we do what
goes
into
what
fund.
Too. Thank you, Ms. Mingy.
Madam Chair, Representative, the federal basic health program payments are deposited in the Basic Health Program Trust Fund, which is in the state's federal fund in the state treasury, and it has to live there as opposed to being combined with the Health Care Access Fund, just as a component of our BHP blueprint. We can't have the fund sort of commingling for the integrity of the program, but those resources are sort of living within their own sort of little account in the state treasury and aren't used for anything other than basic health program expenditures.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you. It's just confusing because we know there's a lot of federal money and it's like, where is it?
Yep. Thank you. Thank you.
Madam Chair, the
Mingy.
I believe that members have in their packets, I hope, and I'm happy to provide it if not, a copy of the November 2018 forecast fund balance and description, and recognizing the sort of ongoing interest in understanding the BHP and the BHP funding, we have added in our last couple forecasts additional detail on that so we can understand sort of how much money is there, what's changing from forecast to forecast, because there are a lot of sort of factors external to the state processes that can drive the balance in that fund. So there's more information there, and I'm always happy to meet with members to talk about that.
Thank you, Ms. McGee. And I just have a sort of a basic question about this. And members, we're probably not going to have time today for a lot of discussion about the issue, but believe me, we will have that discussion, if not in this committee. It probably will in this committee and probably in a lot of other committees as well. But on your slide on number 4, where you show the dropping off of the revenue coming into the fund after the sunset of the provider tax, I just want to clarify, you talked before about, or maybe it was Mr. Berg talked about the expenses that are being paid out of the fund and how it goes into deficit. And since you can't, you know, it's like if you have a glass of water and you drain the water out of it, you can't have a deficit. You either have water or you have no water. So can you just make it really clear to members what happens to that $800 million and those other expenses that are coming out of the fund when we go into that deficit? So, I mean, it's kind of like what would the graph look like if we were doing this for the expenses, not just the revenue? Ms. Bingy.
Madam Chair, that's a great question, and I think it flows nicely to the sort of my last chart, which is that this does attempt to reflect our best, you know, forecast using our forecast guidelines of the projected uses of the Health Care Access Fund. And the way that we forecast this was to look at our rules about setting base and what we hope to do is to work with members or with decision makers generally to sort of provide advice to answer that question. There's not a simple or straightforward answer. Mr. Berg laid out a number of options, which are bring additional revenue into the fund, lower spending in the fund, but there isn't necessarily a simple trigger for what happens to the expenditures in the fund if there is insufficient revenue.
So Ms. Mahia, so I think what you just said is that we don't really know because we have to make some decisions because it sounds like those expenses could just go unpaid or they would have to be paid out of some other source. I mean, obviously, the general fund, they could shift to the general fund, but that there's no clear legislation. There's no legislative answer to that right now. So, in other words, there's a sunset on the fund, but there's certainly not a sunset on the expenses that the fund is paying for, and you're both nodding your heads. Is that fair to say?
Yes. Madam Chair, I think that's fair to say.
Okay. All right. We will leave it at that. So we are at the end of our time here, and thank you very much for your presentation. And, of course, everybody knows Mr. Berg is here every day that we meet, so he's always available for questions, and he's very helpful if you need to have something explained, and appreciate everyone's attention today. We are adjourned. This doesn't work out.